This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're replaying conversations we've had about music, from interviews with music greats like Judy Collins to in-studio performances by local musicians. We begin with an age-old musical rivalry, the Beatles versus the Stones. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. It's an epic rivalry that started in the 20th century and will persist as long as mankind does. That's the Beatles versus the Stones. Joining us to talk about how this battle of the bands came to be is John McMillian. John is a professor of history at Georgia State University, and the latest book is Beatles versus Stones. And by the way, you can catch him tonight at a great place, 7 o'clock at the Harvard Bookstore. By the way, he will not answer the question about who is better, but you can at 877-301-8970. John, great to meet you.
It's nice to meet you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, pleasure. There's all this fascinating stuff that I knew nothing about in your writing. But one of the things, and start with this, is that the Beatles supposedly were not these mop-top little nice boys, but thugs, whereas the Rolling Stones were the gentlemen that were turned into thugs for marketing purposes. Is that really true?
Thugs is a strong word, but that's what someone has said about the Beatles. You know, they came from these working class backgrounds in Liverpool, and, you know, they were known for getting in fights, and they played in leather jackets, and John Lennon especially was sort of a delinquent in his community and a known troublemaker. But, you know, under the influence of their manager, Brian Epstein, they decided to bow and conform and be polite, and they styled themselves differently than their bohemian origins would suggest.
Yeah, because, well, they always, when you saw them, I know I've seen pictures of them when they were younger in the leather jackets. Then, of course, when they came to the United States, it was those little thin ties, and they were all dressed up in the suits. So that was just artifice for marketing.
That's exactly right.
You know, when I first heard about your book about, I guess, a week ago or so, John, I assumed that every review was going to be same tired old thing, been there, done that, retread. Every review I've read almost shock says everything here is new. It's unbelievable how much he has brought to a discussion 50 years or whatever it is after the fact. So where did you go that other people had not gone before in terms of source material and that sort of thing?
You know, my first book is called Smoking Typewriters, and it was on the underground press in the late 1960s mm-hmm. and early 70s. And you know, just about every campus or community had these radical tabloid newspapers back then. And there was a big debate in the late 60s about the different ideological perspectives of the Beatles and the Stones. And no one had really turned to these underground newspapers as source material before. And so this book grew a bit out of my first book. And I used a lot with the underground newspapers and also teen magazines and fan magazines from the early 60s.
You wrote that which I did not know, the monthly fan magazine for the Stones and the Beatles was written by the same guy.
They had the same publisher.
I love that.
That was great. That was great. And also, I mean, the appeal, at least initially, for the Stones was much more young boys, where there were all these, you know, 9-year-old pictures we all see from Shea Stadium, everybody weeping and crying, all these little teeny boppers and tweeners and all that kind of stuff. But males, why was that?
I'm not exactly sure, but, you know, a lot of people forget just how young the Beatles audience was when they were first getting going. It was very young girls. And the Stones were one of the first bands from that era to attract a male following. And you know, a lot of young men, I think, you know, tended to snicker a little bit about the pop acts that were coming out of England, but then for whatever reason, the Stones were appealing to them. And so they would literally be sort of muscling themselves up to the front of the stage and pushing the young girls out of the way.
Well, you know, it's like a boy band thing, the same kind of phenomenon now, you see. Or if you go to one of those horrible concerts, who was that woman we all had to go see with our kids were little, the blonde Miley Cyrus, whatever her name was, that got in trouble. I mean, you go to these concerts and everybody would be...
You mean the blonde Miley Cyrus who we've never heard from since? Is that
well,
what you're talking about? That one?
Yeah, now,
Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, but the little girls there would be like 11 years old in the whole audience. And it was the same thing for the Beatles early on, which of course it's true, but I
Well, you can't
it.
See the video for Shea Stadium or something like that where the young girls lined up in the front rows where these young kids are literally in full swoon. It was unbelievable. We're talking to the author of Beatles versus Stones, John McMillian, and he goes out of his way to say he is not going to take sides, but we'd like you to take sides at 877-301-8970. Whom do you prefer and why? What was the level of, you write about this, the competition between both the bands and particularly individuals like Lennon and Jagger? What was that all about and how did they feel about each other?
Well, it's a complicated dynamic and, of course, the relationship evolved over time. And that's one thing I try to chronicle in the book. But, you know, on balance, I describe them as having a kind of a competitive friendship. And, you know, you can be friends with someone and also want to outperform them. And both groups were trying to best the other one in terms of their, you know, record sales and cultural influence and aesthetic credibility. You know, they were keenly in competition, but they also enjoyed each other's company and they socialized and bonded over a lot of their shared experiences.
But isn't there a line somewhere that, and I'm paraphrasing, where Lennon says something like, every time I do anything, every time we put out a new single, and then he drops a couple of F-bombs, Mick, as in Jagger, is doing the exact same thing 2 months later. Now, is that said with a smile on his face, or is that said with derision for the Stones and for Mick Jagger?
Well, it's interesting. That interview was with Jan Wenner, the publisher of Rolling Stone, and it was recorded, and it's easy to find online, so you can hear his tone and his inflection. I think that was a famously cranky interview. And so he did sometimes feel like the Stones were kind of glomming on to what the Beatles were doing. But in that period in 1970, John Lennon was just in a very unhappy space, and he really lashed out against Mick Jagger. But that was a little bit uncharacteristic of how he really felt.
Why in 1970 was he in an unhappy space?
Well, the Beatles had broken up. He was using drugs, heroin. He felt a lot of pressure. Because he was being challenged on his political views and about his relationship with Yoko Ono. And he was sort of, you know, going out into some new, you know, territory and breaking away from the Beatles.
You know what else I found interesting is that it took the Beatles a long time. You mentioned before that they were playing in these kind of little seedy bars and stuff like that before they got noticed. But the Stones, not so much. Why the quicker ascension for the Stones?
I think in large part because the Beatles just opened up this tremendous market. You know, the Beatles spent, as you said, about 5 years playing together. John and Paul, at least, have been playing together for 5 years before they got their recording contract. And they're famous for playing in West Germany and really, you know, they logged hundreds and hundreds of performance hours. And then by the time they got their record contract in 1962, they were doing really well. And then they had such tremendous success that everyone was looking for another Beatles, you know. And first it was the Liverpool groups that were riding the Beatles' coattails, but then someone looked to London, and originally the Stones were going to be presented as successors to what the Beatles were doing.
So the idea that the Beatles were the mop tops and they, I want to hold your hand, versus the Stones rape and pillage thing, again, that was it to be the other side, the yin yang for the Beatles.
Yeah, to a large degree. Although when the Stones were first getting going for a few months there, there's a picture in my book of them wearing matching outfits. They have vests and ties, and they have, you know, they're smiling and their hair's short. And at first, they really, I think, wanted to style themselves kind of like a Liverpool group. And then they changed their image. They went through a transformation.
Yeah, speaking of Liverpool, one of my favorite words in the English language has nothing to do with anything. Is Liverpool's an adjective. Is it Liverpudlian? Is that the proper? Mm-hmm. Oh, God, I love that.
It is?
Yeah, it is. You never know that? You know, one of the things I was totally unaware of, one of many things, I've only read about 75 pages of your book, but I had no idea that they had ever done the same song. And it turns out that there's a Beatles song, which I actually love, I Want to Be Your Man, written by Lennon and McCartney, that was covered by the Rolling Stones. Can we hear a little bit of this? First, let's hear the Stones cover, and then we'll hear the Beatles version. Here it is, I Want to Be Your Man. And how about a little Beatles here too, John Parker, if you would. I'm almost embarrassed to ask this question. I know all Beatles and Stones fans are going to say, he doesn't know the answer to this question. Was there ever a cover of a Stones song by the Beatles? And did the Stones ever cover another Beatles song besides this?
When they were first getting going, they covered a couple of the same songs. That song Money, I can't remember the artist, and then they covered a Chuck Berry song that they would play in their live performances. But this is the only song that John Lennon and Paul McCartney kind of donated to the Rolling Stones, and it was the Rolling Stones' second big, you know, hit single in England.
Why did they donate it to the why did they give it to the Stones? What was that about?
Partly as a gesture of friendship. You know, John Lennon and Paul McCartney were in such a fertile creative period. They were writing songs not just for the Beatles records, but for other artists as well. And people wanted to record John and Paul's songs because it gave them a lot of prestige. And it's just a funny story. One day the Beatles were coming back from an award luncheon, or John and Paul were rather, and they ran into Andrew Luke Oldham, who was the manager of the Stones, and he was in a downbeat mood because the Stones couldn't find a new song to record. And so John and Paul said, well, we have a new song that sounds like something you could do. It's kind of a Bo Diddley-ish number. It sounds like you'd do well with this. So they went to where the Stones were rehearsing, and finished the song right there on the spot and said, here, use this. And the Stones were really impressed to see the Beatles so effortlessly finish a song.
I think the Stones did it better, too. It was a better song
for
them. We have an email from Sebastian, and maybe you could comment on this. He said that there was a moment in London when Let It Be was number one by the Beatles, of course, and Let It Bleed by the Stones was number two. That's amazing.
Sure. No, they were they had a lot of records that sold really well, and they were in competition. Although, you know, the Beatles usually outsold the Stones by a pretty wide margin.
Why?
Oh, I don't know why. They're
I hate to use
popular.
The word more mainstream. I mean, isn't
well, they
it,
were more mainstream. I mean, the line that it's your the Stones were the band your parents hated, mm-hmm. and you know the and there'd be all these things about whether you were a Paul girl when I was a kid or a Ringo girl or a George girl. There was more of a much more of a you could listen to the Beatles with your mother.
Who was a Ringo girl? How many Ringo girls did you know growing up, Marjorie?
Almost none. But
that's
the intellectuals,
figured, yeah.
The intellectuals were the John girls. The cheerleaders were the Paul girls, and the creative kind of dressed in black ones were the George girls. And I don't know who was a Ringo girl, but you know that was how it broke down, Jim.
I was a Keith Richard boy until I found out he snorted his father, and then I figured I've had enough of that. In any case, 877-301-8970. We're speaking to John McMillian, who's written this terrific book, Beatles versus Stones. We're going to get a couple of calls and hear who you prefer and why. Let's start in Lowell with Joe. Joe, you're on with John McMillian. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, hey, Joe.
I was thinking about differences between the two groups regarding movies. And it appears that the Rolling Stones songs appear in about, what I could research, 13 movies, while the Stones are in 10 movies. And the type of movies that... you're going to find the Rolling Stones are in the bad guy type movies like Mean Streets and the Departed, Casino, Goodfellas.
Mm. Oh,
although the Apocalypse Now, they're all Rolling Stone type movies. Well, they're a type of movie, and that's where the Rolling Stones have had a lot of success in there, and especially the song "Gimme Shelter." That's in about 4 or 5 movies.
So where's the Beatles? Were they the revised version of Bambi or something? Where was it, Joe?
Oh, the Beatles were the feel-good movies, like Social Network and those genre type of movies, although they do share one movie. The Royal Tonnenbaums have both a Beatles song and a Rolling Stones song.
Wow.
Excellent research.
Very good.
Joe, that is
Joe,
very
that was great. Thank
impressive.
You.
Impressive. Thanks. Do you look at all the movie work of the two bands, Joe? John?
No, but as Joe was talking, I was thinking that he makes a really neat point that I probably should have brought up in the book. That was a shrewd observation.
Yeah.
You know, one of the
mob movies were big with the Stones, I guess.
Well, you almost hear the throbbing beats really fit the environment of those movies. Politics, obviously the bands, they started and reached their, I guess, at least their, in the Beatles, it was their only time, it was the 60s, and then the Rolling Stones soon thereafter. What misconceptions do we have about the politics of both of these sets of players, the Stones and the Beatles?
Well, it's interesting. You know, in the late 60s, the Beatles were very much associated with the counterculture and the aesthetic radicalism and peace and love and all of that. And the Stones in the late 60s were thought to be more of a militant street fighting band that related to the politics of confrontation that the student militants and the new left was putting across. And yet, in fact, neither group was terribly political. You know, the Beatles, you know, they had a hippie or countercultural sensibility, but they never got involved in trying to end the Vietnam War or, you know, trying to overturn racism or ban the atomic bomb or anything like that. And nor did the Stones. And yet in the late 60s, young people really felt that there was a kind of ideological contest between the two groups. And people felt that they had to take a stand.
But don't you think, you know, can we play a little bit piece of Revolution in the background bound by the Beatles? I would bet that if you were to poll the average Beatles fans at this time, they would say, these guys are exactly where I am politically. Was that was that sort of a conscious positioning on that part, or is that just us wanting them or wishing that they were where they apparently were not? You know what I mean?
Well, I think the Beatles maybe telegraphed part of their sensibility, and so, you know, they were in fact opposed to the Vietnam War, and they didn't like segregation and racism. But, you know, under the influence of their manager, they were told never to really take a big stand and maybe alienate some fans or get involved in controversy that wasn't necessary. And so maybe their attitudes were a little bit sublimated. But certainly they were seen as, you know, generational heroes and leaders by young people.
You know, I would imagine, though, that the Beatles and maybe the Stones, too, are much more popular with white kids.
The Beatles were more popular with white kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Stones had that kind of gritty blues background, and they really loved the music coming out of Mississippi and Chicago and so on. And so maybe African-Americans might be more likely to be Stones fans, although the fan base for both groups seems mostly white.
Yeah. No, I was going to say mostly. And at that same time, there was all that great Motown music.
Someone asked Barack Obama a few years ago which band he preferred, and I was interested to find out that he liked the Stones better.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Am I
surprised? As you're saying, were you surprised by that, John?
I wasn't sure what to think.
Nor am I, actually. Well, especially since
thing. I've always thought there's more of a macho thing with the Rolling Stones and more of a girl thing with the Beatles. I mean, Michelle, My Belle, all songs like that. There's a lot of, like, pretty sappy love songs, especially Paul McCartney after he left John Lennon. Oh, my God. It's like a sap-a-thon. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Let me give you the email address, bpr@wgbh.org. Do you like the Beatles or the Stones?
And you got to say why very clearly. Before we get back to the phone calls, though, did you see 20 Feet from Stardom? Have you seen the movie? There is a great 20 Feet from Stardom, for those who haven't seen, we've mentioned repeatedly because I just love the film.
It was great.
This is the film of the backup singers for some of the great bands and performers of all time. And there's maybe the best set of scenes in the whole movie is Mick Jagger talking about this woman who's doing backup and singing rape, murder, it's just a shot away. And the woman tells a story about being in her pajamas and curlers at her hotel room.
And she's pregnant.
When she's called by her manager, says some group, the Rolling Stones, wants you to sing backup. And she obviously not. Here's a piece of sympathy for the devil.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith.
You know, Chris Matthews got upset with you when you mentioned a thrill up his leg about 6 months ago when he was on with us. I get a thrill up my leg when I hear that song. It's unbelievable. Let's go to Paul. You're on South Shore, and you're on with John McMillian, who's the author of Beatles versus Stones. Hey, Paul.
How are you doing today?
Excellent.
Good. I have a friend who lives down this way in Abington. His name is Victor Moulton. He was a part of the band, The Barbarians. They had a hit song called Are You a Boy or Are You a Girl? And I don't know if you remember that song. I guess it was kind of like a one-hit wonder. But
yeah.
They did, I think, a couple of tours with the Stones. And I was talking with Victor about his career. And he had told me that he was on several of these tours with the Stones here in the United States. And I think they were on a TV program. I forget what it was called, them and James Brown and the Stones. Also, it got released on DVD. But he said no one could touch the Beatles. In other words, at the time that his band was popular, the Stones and the Barbarians were kind of like equal, like as if maybe they really hadn't quite taken off, even in the mid-60s.
You know, we have to let you go only because you have a horrible connection with the Barbarians. I love the name. You know, as he's speaking, I'm thinking we all know and have seen, even if we didn't see it live at the time, the Ed Sullivan moment for the Beatles. What was the Rolling Stones' first appearance in the United States on television, for example? Where did they appear?
If I remember correctly, it was on a show that Dean Martin hosted.
Dean Martin?
Yeah, and it was kind of a West Coast version of you know, maybe the Ed Sullivan show, a kind of a competitor as a variety program. And the Stones were really unhappy because they only got to play about a minute of their song, and they were ridiculed and heckled by Dean Martin. He was making fun of them for their appearance and really, you know, looking down on them, and the Stones were a little bit put off.
You know, speaking of the Stones, where was it? We're going to play a little sound from Let's Spend the Night Together in a second. Where was it where they had to change the words for the song. Is it for American television? I just where was that?
That was on Ed Sullivan, and it was Ed Sullivan. They had to say, "Let's spend some time together."
Did they have a problem? What was the back and forth about that?
You can see the clip on YouTube. You know what Mick Jagger does is he just rolls his eyes and acts
as
mischievous as he possibly can as he says "time." Instead
oh God.
Of, night. Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of that if we can in the background while Marjorie's bringing up something else. Go ahead, Marjorie.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about Mick Jagger's politics. I mean, do we know even now what his politics are?
Not so much, I don't think. I've heard him say that he voted for the Labour Party, but he's a pretty savvy business guy, and he's pretty cagey about his personal views.
The other thing I was going to ask you, too, about the Beatles, to me, and I'm not a music expert, but it seemed to me that there was much more of a transformation of the Beatles to go from these little, you know, teeny bopper love songs, I Want to Hold Your Hand, to all the psychedelic stuff. I mean, they really, and I didn't see that same kind of transformation in the Rolling Stones. They sort of, to me, ended up being what they started out being.
Well, I think that might be overstating a bit because the Stones did really morph and evolve, but I agree with your first point. I teach classes on the 1960s. And a lot of times I'll show a clip from the Beatles in 1962 and then something from maybe Revolver in 1966. And you see this just incredible transformation in just a few years. And I just sort of use that to illustrate how quickly the culture changed in the 60s.
So tell me about the Stones.
Wait, I want to hold it. Before you get to this, your statement before, these simple teeny bopper, I Want to Hold Your Hand, some of the most brilliant music in the history of the universe were those simple, as you call them,
they were very
short. They were incredible.
We all got the Beatles CD, the number one songs. I noticed how short a lot of those songs were. They were like
2.5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. But tell me about the transformation of the Rolling Stones then.
Well, I think somewhat under the Beatles' influence, the Stones tried to kind of reposition themselves in the mid-60s as a group that was more, you know, sonically ambitious, and they were maturing as songwriters and writing about autobiographical themes and about societal problems and so on. And that was a big step for them as well.
So could you tell me a song that illustrated the beginning and a song that illustrated that more transformed Stones?
Well, I don't know. In the early records, the Stones weren't even writing their own songs. They were covering blues numbers. And Keith Richards and Mick Jagger hadn't even matured as songwriters. But later on, they would write about themes that would appeal to young bohemians, about lust and sex and consumerism and these types of things. They would really skewer genteel society in England. And if they weren't specifically political, they had a kind of bohemian sensibility.
I love that term, bohemian, too. Let's go back to the phone calls.
You feel you have a bohemian sensibility.
No, you have the point. You know what has ruined the term bohemian? What has ruined the term bohemian for everyone in America? The Bohemian Club in Northern California.
Oh.
You know this. Where
I've been trying
high-level government officials, men, would dress up as women to whatever.
I want to have a bohemian sensibility, but hasn't worked out for me
Suzanne,
yet.
You're in Newton. You're on with John McMillian, who's written a terrific new book, Beatles versus Stones. Hey there, Suzanne.
Hi, I love this topic. This is great.
Good.
And especially for my generation. Now that's the who.
That's right.
Anyway, but I was going to say that, like, from childhood on up, I listened to the Beatles because I was born in 61. And so that was what, you know, that's like my background music for my life.
Yeah.
But as far as, like, getting puberty and excited and crazy, it was the Stones. So, you know, there's just a whole different, like, I think if I'm in the car and I hear a Stone song, I dive on it and turn it up, you know. But if it's the Beatles, I'm like, oh, yeah, I know that, like, the back of my, a little bit, I live it, you know, I hear it all the time. But so that's, I have both. I love both. I'm by rock and roll.
Bye, rock and roll. That's a good line. Boy, there's a lot of happiness in your voice,
Suzanne, that's
thanks
a great,
for a great call.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Dan from Worcester. What do you think, Dan?
Dan? Let's put him on hold. We'll get back to him in a second. Joe, you're in New Hampshire. You're on with John McMillian, the author of Beatles versus Stones. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I grew up with two sisters, and I always had to steal the albums in order to listen to what I wanted to listen to. And I started out with, like, the early Beatles, and I thought they were great, you know? But then I found the Stones through the pile one day. And once I put on the Stones, it's exactly like, Marjorie, it's just what you said. You know, that it was mostly, it's almost like it was geared towards little girls screaming and crying over these guys. But when you got to the Stones, it was dirty, it was gritty, it was blues. It just, I don't know, it's more for a guy.
Yeah.
And that's the way it made you feel. You know, when you listen to it, you felt like, all right, now I'm going to throw my leather jacket on and go outside, you know?
Exactly.
Get a couple of tattoos on the way home.
Hey, yeah, that's exactly the way it made you feel.
Hey, Joe, that's a great call. Thank you so much.
Little sexism in the old Stones, you know, under my thumb. That always made you feel like you were.
I like that song, too. Hey, Joe McMillian, what's the, after having written the thing, what's the piece that most surprised you that you learned going in as compared to going out and finishing the work about both bands?
Well, let's see. I went into it knowing a bit about both bands already. I think exploring the dynamic of the regarding the fact that they were both friends and rivals was the most interesting thing to try to piece together. You know, because it's possible that you can be both, you know, and so they navigated that relationship in interesting ways, and it was always fluctuating.
You know, one of the things that was amazing to me, I don't know if you saw the piece on 60 Minutes ago. I'm really embarrassed. What's the name of the photographer who died? Grossman, is that his name? Who did all these incredible photographs. I'd never even heard of him, frankly, of both the Beatles and JFK in particular. He's a photographer. He traveled with them a lot. Some of the photos they showed on 60 Minutes, I think it was a week ago Sunday, showed even after the Beatles were huge, he went into the homes of at least a couple of them, and they were living the most middle-class kind of existences, from furniture to surroundings. What were their lives like? I mean, what was that like in the early days when they all of a sudden started making mounds and mounds of money? How much did they change, both sets of people?
Well, it's interesting. I didn't see that segment. You know, the Beatles were really into making a lot of money, and a lot of people thought later on, you know, as the 60s got underway, that they were trying to... I don't know how to put this exactly right. Some people thought that the Beatles were not materialistic, that they had transcended that, but that's not really the case. Early on, they wanted to make a lot of money, and they felt that they were going to be a fad. They only had a few years where they were going to be big, and then they were going to fade away, so they were working really hard. And I'm a little surprised to hear that their homes were seemed sort of middle class.
Well, it was one in particular, and I think it was McCartney, but I'm not 100% sure.
Well, Paul McCartney, interestingly, moved in with his girlfriend's parents in London for a little while, so that he might have been an exception. John Lennon was known for, you know, he would just spend money like crazy and buy things he didn't need, and he had Rolls Royces and suits of armor that would decorate his house, and you know, all these sorts of things.
And then right after that, he said, imagine no possessions. It was a perfect segue. Let's take one more for John McMillian. He's the author of Beatles versus Stones. John, you were on the road somewhere. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey there, John.
Oh, hey. Thanks for picking up.
Pleasure. You're on. Go.
Yeah, I first heard about the Stones. I had a pen pal from England. It was around eighth grade. I was already aware of the Beatles. And he said, you probably haven't heard of these guys yet, but the Rolling Stones are my favorite. And he was talking about the mods and the rockers. And I guess the mods were the young people who dressed more stylishly, the Carnaby Street and all that. And the rockers were definitely the more leather motorcycle set. But the reason I think I liked the Beatles first was because it was the best make-out music. Kind of hard to get the state in the mood with Street Fighting, man. It was more like Norwegian Wood.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Thanks, John,
thank
for
you.
The call.
You know, John, I have one question. I know you don't want to choose between which is better, the better band, the Beatles or the Stones, but I would think when people look back that write about music and its impact and stuff, they're both going to be about in the same place in terms of impact on the culture and impact on the time, I would think, because they're... You know, they're both obviously fantastic bands.
Yeah, I think they're comparable. Although the Beatles, you know, of course, they broke up in 1970 and they never got back together in any form or fashion. And I think that and maybe enhanced their legacy to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the Stones have soldiered on. And again, I don't write about, you know, my aesthetic judgments too much in the book. But I guess I will say that, you know, in the later years, as the Stones have gotten older, their quality of their output has declined. And they're sort of a nostalgia act now. They still did a recent tour, but they were still playing the same old hits from 30 and 40 years ago, and they played them exactly as they were recorded, you know, and so they were appealing to, you know, these baby boomers. And, you know, in that sense, maybe I think they diminished some of their legacy.
Yeah, how long can they soldier on?
It was the 50th anniversary
75
tour.
75 bopping around the stage if Mick Jagger can physically do it?
You know, in the epilogue, I describe a scene from a movie that I like called Almost Famous. You might have seen.
Yes.
Cameron Crowe.
Yeah.
There's a scene in there where a rock manager played by Jimmy Fallon is trying to encourage his band. The movie's set in 1973.
Right.
And he's trying to encourage his band to really strike while the iron is hot. And he tells him, you know, if you think Mick Jagger is going to be out there at age 50 still trying to be a rock star, you are sadly, sadly mistaken.
That's great.
And here he is now at age 70.
God.
You know, as we thank John McMillan, you know what we should do? Because this is clearly the thematic music of this show. Can you play All You Need Is Love in the background, please, as Marjorie thanks John McMillan? Oh, we don't have it. So then don't. I think that's perfect. Then.
Oh, okay.
Play anything
play
as
anything.
We leave. Yeah.
John McMillan is a professor of history at Georgia State University. His latest book is Beatles vs. Stones. Up next, we talk to Judy Collins. She joined us earlier this year. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, today's show is all about music, from musicians to how music affects the way wine tastes. We pick things up with the great Judy Collins. Judy was in town earlier this year for a WGBH fundraising event, and she was good enough to sit with us in Studio 3 as we were wrapping up a pledge shift.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever.
So I am in full swoon, that is all my life. By Judy Collins. I almost can't speak.
First of all, we have to say thank you for calling and giving your donation.
I know. Well, say it. Go ahead.
I love you, a bushel and a peck, a bushel and a peck, and a hug around the neck, hug around the neck, and a barrel and a heap, a barrel and a heap, and I'm talking about you in my sleep, or however it goes.
Okay. Now, we have to ask you.
I'm going to pass out.
You have a fantastic voice. Many people post 50 lose their voice. I assume you never smoke cigarettes.
Oh, yes.
You did? Well, how do you keep your voice? I mean, it's unusual.
It is unusual. I'm very lucky. I have done everything in my power to keep what I was given, and it was a great gift at birth.
Yeah.
I was always a student, whether I was playing piano or learning to meditate or learning Russian when I went to Russia in 1965. And in 1965, I was already working so hard that I was having great problems with my voice, great problems. I would have further things that were even more serious, but this was definitely serious. And I found a teacher and I studied with him for 32 years.
Wow.
He was recommended by Harry Belafonte's guitarist, Ray Bogusloff, and also by a couple who ran an arts camp in the Berkshires, Morty and I forget their last name, but I'll think of it in a minute, Bauman, Morty and Irma Bauman, and they knew everything about everybody. And these people, unbeknownst to one another, both gave me the same name, and I called this man. I had his phone number in my purse. I was really in trouble. And I called him up and I said, you know, I had just moved from the village up to the Upper West Side because my therapist was on the Upper West Side.
Always good to be close to your shrink. I'm with
right.
you, totally.
And I called him up and I said, you know, I've been told about you. Max Margulies was his name. And I've been told about you from a couple of sources. And I began to tell him about it. He said, you know, I don't really take any students. And I said, I begged and pleaded and whined, you know. And he said, well, maybe you should. So he said, I said to him, where do you live? And he gave me the address. And I walked out my front door, turned left past the elevator, and rang his bell.
Oh, God, that's great.
And I studied with him for...
And he gave you techniques.
He told me what to do.
Okay.
Why are you performing so much? I think it's great you do, and we're very excited. Well, I mean, you're going to be on the Wilbur. We mentioned September 21st.
I mean, what's so terrible about having to make a living?
Yeah.
But you do 100-plus shows a year. I would argue, not knowing your financial condition, that's probably more than you need to do.
Well, not really. You know, what's happened to the music industry is that we're all working, I think, at least two, sometimes three times as hard for the same money. That's what's happened.
Why?
No record labels.
Oh.
Everybody's on the road. And also there are certain times you go through. I mean, that's kind of the face of it. But the truth is that I would never give this up. I would never stop working. I don't intend to ever stop working. And I do. I must have known that when I was very young because, you know, I have always tried to keep things. I was trained by classical pianists, a woman who was the first conductor in the world, actually, of symphony orchestras.
Wow.
And these people always get better at the end of their careers. So I think I always had that in my mind, too.
Are you better now?
Oh, yeah.
How are you better?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'll find out on September 21st.
Yes, you will.
Can you
write home about that and talk about it?
How are you better, Judy Collins?
I'm a better storyteller. I'm a better singer. I'm a better sport. I'm a better all-around. I mean, I really have something that's been given to me, which I've been working on and honing, but it involves a whole creative experience when I'm on stage.
When you're standing in front of 1,000, whatever number of people that are obviously adoring you, is it still as exciting as it was?
I break into In My Life. Oh, it's more exciting. It's much more. It's always been exciting, but it's what I need to stay on the planet. That's simply put. That's what I need to do. To stay here.
And do you go, I always wonder when someone has written so many great songs and performed so many fabulous covers, when everybody's got a favorite, everybody's got a mountain of favorites. When you're performing, I know you tell stories and you talk a lot, so obviously there's this interactive thing. When someone yells out to sing something that you have sung, let's say, Someday Soon, like Marjorie
yes,
loves and has been
song.
Playing
it's
nonstop
romantic.
For the 4 millionth
it is.
Time,
yeah.
do you say to yourself, even if you don't, enough already. I've
no,
done this.
No,
no?
No, 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 no.
Why? Because they love it or because you love
no, because
it?
Because I love it and I can do it.
Because I
know. You know, you said in interviews, and you were just alluding it to it there, that actually you want to be used up when you leave this mortal coil. You want to be done. And so I guess that's you're doing that now. But you've also, there was a great quote, I think it was an interview you might have given here on WGBH-TV, talking about some of your contemporaries, like the great Pete Seeger, who just passed away, mm-hmm. that if people that you grew up with in Greenwich Village, if they're not dead yet, they're thriving.
Yeah, so they're certainly working.
Yeah. So who else of the people that you were with as a young folk singer do you think are like bopping around all over the place like
well,
you?
Well, Joni's traveling all over the.
Joni Mitchell.
Joni Baez.
Joni Baez.
Mitchell doesn't do anything.
Because Joni Mitchell's voice has been very affected by her smoking.
Yeah. Well, there are other things I think that impact us. You know, everybody is vulnerable at some point.
Yeah.
And you have to try to limit your vulnerability so that it doesn't wreck your life. And that's really the job of all of us, really. Oh, but there are a lot of people. I'm out on the road doing some shows with Don McLean in the past year.
Really?
And we have the best
really?
Time. And he's cooking. He's singing. You know, he has a wonderful voice, and he's singing up a storm. And we just love it. But many, many singers.
Joan Baez, you've done a lot of work with her.
And Joan and I are old
duets.
Friends. We've done a
wonderful.
Yeah, we've done a couple of duets.
They're
did
wonderful.
One of Pete's songs, and then she and Mimi and I did a song called Linda Girlchild or something. I've never understood the song at all, so it's one of the few things I've ever sung that I couldn't tell you a thing about it.
Do you happen to say, you know, one of the last, I saw a friend of mine runs Farm Aid, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Willie Nelson's
course,
thing.
Of course, Willie, I've been to Farm Aid.
You have? Mm. I was watching on streaming because I couldn't get there this year. Pete Seeger was there in, what was he, 93 or whatever he was at the time, and he does the final bit where all the board members come out. Nelson, Neil Young, Mellencamp, Dave Matthews. It was really one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen. I mean, Pete, give us a second on Pete Seeger for those.
A second. Where have all the flowers gone? When I do my shows now in the last 3 weeks since his death, I sing that song and the audience sings, and then in between I tell stories about my friendship with him, which goes back, you know, to 1961. We knew each other from that year, and we did concerts, of course, at Carnegie Hall. I was on the board of directors of Newport with him and with some other people, Pete Seeger, Peter Yarrow, and George Ween, of course. And so I've known him, and I've visited him, and we're friends, and we celebrated our birthdays together because mine was the first. He is the first. His is the third, and Theo Bicall was the second. So Harold would always throw us mutual parties together. The last time that my husband and I went up to, the last concert I saw him do was with Arlo in November 30th at Carnegie Hall. And he didn't Arlo said, you know, he can. He probably can't sing. I mean, he can't certainly sing, but he will know the songs and he'll certainly sing along because he's written them all.
Now, I've read that you sing on your voicemail. So if I were to call Judy Collins, I get a song. What's the song?
I'll be seeing you in all your familiar places.
And boy, we hope terrific. You do, Judy Collins.
We're almost out of time. You can give me a thumbs up, thumbs down. Was it fun dropping acid with Bob Dylan?
It was John Phillips and Michelle Phillips.
Oh, I thought it was Bob Dylan.
It could have been.
Was it fun? Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows?
We were speaking with award-winning singer-songwriter Judy Collins. Up next, we speak with one of her peers, a musician whom she inspired by way of her blue eyes. A conversation with Graham Nash is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just joining us, today's show is all about music, from old-timers to new young musicians based in Boston. We continue the show with Graham Nash. He was in town earlier this year to talk about his new book, Wild Tales.
In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can tell.
Still my heart. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marg Regan. We're listening to Graham Nash's Chicago. It's from his 1971 solo album, Songs for Beginners. The wildly talented man behind that song is here with us in Studio 3. You can catch him tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Wilbur. We'll tell you how to get tickets in a minute. You can also catch up on his life by way of his new book, just out today, actually, Wild Tales, A Rock and Roll Life. Graham Nash, pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
How are you both doing?
Oh, we're great. And thank you so much for being here. I'm glad your son stepped out. Is his son in the control room over there?
I don't
there?
Know where he is. He was
I
here
hope
a minute
he's not
ago.
There. Because you have written a great book, Wild Tales. But, I mean, we've all heard of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I think you really took it to an extraordinary level. And it's amazing. Look at you. You look pretty good. You've survived all this. You should be 6 feet under.
6 feet under, yeah. It's lonely down there.
Yeah, I guess so. It was crazy.
The truth is, I have had a wild life.
Yeah.
When I got to the end of the manuscript that we'd prepared, I looked down and I thought, wow. I wish I was him. I mean, it just looked incredible to me because, and I said this last night at the Library of Congress, I'm not a man to look backwards. I don't see much, I don't give that much value at all because there's not really much you can do about what happened in the past except maybe apologize. But looking at my life, as I was forced to do because I was writing Wild Tales, it's just been insane. And the thing that I'm enjoying about it is that I can now let it go.
What do you mean, let it go?
It's like a song. You know, when you've got a song going on in your head, you know, it may be complete to you in your head and you may have played it a couple of times, but it's not out of me until I put it on record and it's available for people to listen to. That's what I mean by letting go. Now I can let my life go and get on with the rest of my life, which is going to be incredible.
Well, Graham Nash, you're a great performer, great songwriter, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young at the Hollies when you began. But, you know, I wonder, a lot of us have maybe smoked a joint or two in our wild youth, but you guys were really high a lot of the time, yet managed to write this music and perform it.
I know. And,
how
and
did you do that?
Well, it is what it is. A lot of people say, well, you know, do you think the music would have been any better if you'd have been straight?
Yeah, would it?
I'll never know the answer to that question. I mean, it is what it is. We did all that crazy stuff. We made all that great music and continue to this day.
You know, some of the stuff I learned in the last few days, you say you don't like to look back. I'll look back for you. Simon and Garfunkel, they weren't crazy about the Crosby, Stills, and Nash music.
No, they
George
weren't.
Harrison and Apple said, no, I don't think so. These aren't for us. Right. Is there – what level of satisfaction, personal satisfaction – look at the smile on his face. Personal satisfaction did you get when all of a sudden you became who you became?
We couldn't really understand it because we knew what we had. The Hollies and the Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds were great harmony bands. We knew what good harmony was. We'd all studied with the Everly Brothers and the Louvin Brothers and, you know, so we knew. And we couldn't understand why they didn't get it.
What'd you say the first time you saw George Harrison or Simon or Garfunkel after you guys became who you were?
You know, we never mentioned it.
Because you knew it was in the air, you didn't have to.
It wasn't. I mean, why push it in their face? I mean, it was the smash hit that we thought that we had it, and it made us questioners because, you know, I mean, Paul and Arthur, incredible musicians. George Harrison and Peter Asher, incredible musicians. Why didn't they hear it?
Why didn't they?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
You didn't want to rub it in. You would have rubbed it in, Jim, if you'd been in that situation.
I would forever. You know,
forever, exactly.
I was humming some of your songs to myself this morning, and I'm thinking about you as songwriter for a couple of minutes. You've surrounded yourself in your life, Graham Nash, with some of the great songwriters of our time, from Crosby to Stills to Young to, I think, one of the great songwriters of ever, Joni Mitchell. Did that all make you... Did that make you
better,
more creative, or were you intimidated?
It made me
by
better.
How?
No, you've got to go a long way to intimidate me, Jim. I'm serious. You know, don't forget that my country was devastated twice in 80 years, you know, in World War I and World War II. People from the north of England and from the south of England have an incredible ability to overcome incredible stuff that's going on with them, you know, because you really didn't know at one point whether your house was going to be there or whether your friends were going to be alive. So we have an attitude that is unshakable, and you'd have to go a lot to intimidate me. However, having said that, to be able to stand next to Crosby and Stephen and Neil and Joni and watch them write songs was an incredible learning curve for me. I knew how to write the 2.5-minute pop song that would, you know, give you a melody that you couldn't forget after you'd heard it once. And they were pretty shallow songs. They were good. I mean, you know, Carrie Anne and On a Carousel and Bust Up, they're all fine songs, but they don't mean that much. They're not going to change your life in any meaningful way. When I met David and Stephen and Neil and Joni, my life changed in a very, very big way.
Well, tell us about meeting them. Tell us about when you initially hooked up with Stills and David Crosby. How'd that happen?
I was coming from London to Los Angeles to see Joan. A cab pulled into the driveway of her house at on Laurel Canyon there, on Lookout Mountain. And I heard that she had company, and I didn't quite, you know, wasn't know whether I was ready for that. I was going to meet a girlfriend, and all of a sudden there's, you know, a party going on. Anyway, it was David and Stephen. They were having dinner at Joni's house. And after dinner, David said to Stephen, play Willie, that song that we just did. And it was a song called...
Willie is your middle name, which is how you were called, correct?
Yeah. I know how old my friends are by what they call me. They sang the song. It was beautiful. It was two-part. It was obviously a beautiful song that Stephen had written. I asked them to do it one more time. They played it a second time. They got to the end. They looked at each other. I turned around to him and I said, okay, bear with me here. One more time. I had my part down. I knew what I was doing. I'm a quick study. I pride myself at being reasonably good at what I do. And the sound was amazing. Whatever sound Crosby, Stills, and Nash has was born in the first 30 seconds.
You know, wow. Graham Nash, by the way, Graham Nash is at the Wilbur Theater tomorrow night. We'll tell you how to get tickets in a second. He's got a great new book. It's called Wild Tales. When you say you consider yourself pretty good at what you do, in addition to what most of us know that you do masterfully, you're a great photographer. You have pioneered this digital art printing, sculptor, all this sort of thing. Now you're a grandfather. What are you proudest of, Graham Nash?
My children and my grandchildren.
Is that really what it is?
Absolutely.
Your son was just here a minute ago.
Oh, yeah. No question about it.
And are you a decent father?
I don't think that my kid would take care of me on the road as he does.
This is WGBH 89.7, your source for local news and talk. We're Boston's NPR news and culture station.
They know how I treat people. They know how I deal with my world. They know how level-headed I am. They understand my desperate need to create every single day. My kids understand me, and I'm incredibly proud of them. And the reason, excuse me for just one second.
Oh, that's okay. Go ahead.
The main reason I wrote this book, Wild Tales, was for my children. But they're in their 30s now. They've been with me all their life. They know who I am. My granddaughter was 1 year old a week ago. Stella Joy.
Congratulations. Right?
Thank you. And, of course, as every grandfather says, she's the most beautiful creature in the world. But I really wanted to write it for her as well, for her to know who her grandfather was. Because with all due respect, I might walk out on the street there and die. You never know.
Some of my friends,
you can get hit by a bus, probably not.
So, you know, and I'm almost 72. So how much longer do I have left? How much longer for Stella Joy to find out who her grandfather is? That's the reason I wrote.
How long can you keep it? Speaking of how long do you have left? Forget how long you have left. I hope a long time. How long can you do what you do? Every time someone like you comes to town or Bruce Springsteen comes to town, we usually have a discussion. How old is too old to do another smile on his face? How old is too old to do rock and roll? Is the answer is there's no.
I don't. It used to be don't trust anybody under 30. Over 30,
right.
Remember? And then, you know, they were telling me rock and roll wouldn't last in 1957 in the north of England. And now look at it. How long can I go on? As long as something's happening before my eyes and my heart that I have to respond to.
We're talking with Graham Nash, who's performing at the Wilbur Theatre tomorrow night. There are still a few tickets left, by the way. We can get them at thewilbertheatre.com. He's just written a great new book called Wild Tales.
Thanks.
Here's what I wonder, because you do talk about these wild tales and these beautiful young women, twins and half-clothed, unclothed, all these things, and all the drugs and the weed and the cocaine and other things. When your kids, your dad, you're just told, you have a beautiful little grandchild. When your kids were teenagers, what did you tell them? What advice did you give them? I mean,
I didn't give them any advice. They had better dope than I had.
Okay. So you weren't worried about them?
No, I wasn't worried at all. They're bright, compassionate people with their feet on the ground and concerned about their fellow human beings.
Yep.
They were me walking around. I didn't have to teach them anything. They already know it all.
Graham Nash, you're at the Wilbur tomorrow night. From what I've read, you do some new things that you've written.
Mm-hmm.
These are your own words in a piece I read a couple of days ago. You do some old things that people haven't heard very much.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do classics or your classics, or do you stay away from them? What's your take on this? What are people going to hear tomorrow night?
One of the wonderful things about playing solo, and I'm not really solo. I mean, it's me, but I have James Raymond on keyboards, who is David's son. It's
Crosby's kid, yeah.
Who's a brilliant keyboard player. And Shane Fontaine from England on guitar. So even though it's a solo concert evening with Graham Nash, I do have a couple of brilliant musicians with me. And your question again was, Jim?
I have no idea.
Yes.
Well,
I know. The question was, what I thought I had read was, you do new songs and you do some old ones that people aren't familiar with.
Right.
But do you do either your classics or the Hollies classics?
I do everything that I think that they may want to hear. You must understand something. We have always felt an incredible responsibility to give value for money. We know how hard it is to earn money out there. We know that people have a choice between meds and food for the children. I know all that. And it's incredibly flattering to see them all out there paying good money for a ticket to come and see me. So I have a certain responsibility that I feel to play them the songs that they bought the tickets for in the first place.
Yeah, but there's a great moment on a Joni Mitchell album, and I forget which album it is, where she is, I think it's a live album, where she's talking about someone from the audience yelling out, play, and I forget what it was, maybe A Case of You.
Freebird.
And she, was it? And
I don't know.
And she says, did anyone ever ask Van Gogh to play A Starry Night Again, man? Is there a point at which you say to yourself, I don't want to do those anymore? Or is what the emotion you just described what predominates?
That's the emotion that predominates for me. I play them differently. I play them in different keys, different speeds, different arrangements. Mm-hmm. I have to keep them interesting for myself. But, you know, you can't go to a Graham Nash concert and not hear Our House. I mean, seriously.
Written about you and Joni Mitchell, correct?
Correct, yes.
You know, speaking of Joni Mitchell, Laurel Canyon figures in a lot of her songs and in your book. What was that like then? Was it some beautiful, idyllic little spot right outside Los Angeles, correct?
Not outside Los Angeles. It's in Los Angeles. It's only like 10 minutes from the center of town there, from Hollywood Boulevard. It was an incredible time. It was very sunny. Anything could happen. We were coming out of the summer of love. Everybody wanted to be in a rock and roll band. Every girl wanted to be in a rock and roll band.
One way or another.
One way or another.
That's right.
And it was very much comparable to, say, perhaps Vienna at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
Or Paris in the 1930s when you know, Gertrude Stein was getting artists together and architects together and painters and sculptors and talk about what's going on. And as a matter of fact, Cass Elliot was very much like that.
From the
Mamas and the Papas.
Yeah, she was actually responsible for us being together.
And you talk about some great incidents too, in scenes and stuff. And one of them was this party at Johnny Cash's house in Nashville where Bob Dylan performed. Tell people about that. That's a great story.
I was in Nashville in 1969, and Joni and I were together, and she was booked to do the Johnny Cash show in Nashville. And Bob had had his motorcycle accident. Bob Dylan had had his motorcycle accident a year or two before and hadn't been seen in public for a while, but he was doing the show. After the show went down, which was at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, beautiful, old, fantastic hall, we were invited to dinner at June and Johnny's place. So a bunch of songwriters and a bunch of people from the show, me and Joni and Bob, and I think Christofferson was there, I think Mickey Newbury was there. We're having dinner, right? And all of a sudden, Johnny stands up and he taps this, you know, knife on this glass, you know, to get everyone's attention, which it did immediately, of course. And he said, you know, we have this tradition here at the Cash House that you have to sing for your supper. So there's some guitars over there. Who's going to get up first? Well, nobody knew who I was. No, I wasn't a familiar, iconic-looking man from the Hollies because, you know, who the hell, nobody knew who I was. I was some schlump with Joni, you know. It's like, but nobody was getting up. And there was an incredible vacuum. And I can't stand. I'm kind of like nature that way. I can't stand a vacuum. So even though nobody knew who I was, I had just finished recording the first CSN record, and we'd done a good version of Marrakesh Express, so I thought, ah, hell, I'll get up. So I got up. I do Marrakesh Express. I do it pretty good. I stand up, I turn around and put the guitar on the stand and walk straight into a standing lamp, which crashed to the floor.
Oh, no.
And could have been horrific socially, but it was actually fine because everybody started laughing. It kind of broke the ice. But that's the story you're talking about.
Yeah. And it was a great crowd of people there that night.
Yeah.
You also went to the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations in the city.
Yes.
Why'd you do that?
David and I were on tour in Europe, and the only real, unbiased, straightforward news, surprisingly, was coming from Al Jazeera.
Really?
In Europe. And we watched it every night. And we knew what was going on in Wall Street. And we talked about it every night in Europe. And surprisingly, every time that we mentioned the Occupy movement, the audience would burst out applauding. And that was shocking to us because I don't know whether you've been to Europe much, but when you go to Europe, they don't actually talk about America too much. They're too busy involved in Europe stuff, you know. So we swore to ourselves that as soon as we got back, we would go down to Wall Street and support those people. They had a righteous beef. You know, the gap between the rich and the poor was getting wider by the second. It was obvious the corporate influence in American society is ginormous, of course. And I agree with what they were doing, and so did David. So we took James Raymond, who we mentioned before. He had a one of them little melodica kind of things that you can just carry around. It's about a foot and a half. It's got a little keyboard on there that you blow into to create sound. Because there were no microphones, there were no speakers, there was nothing. There was just acoustic guitars, me and David and James, and several hundred incredibly energetic, clear-thinking people. And I think that a lot of people think that the Wall Street, Occupy movement is dead. But I think that they're moving into politics. I think they're going to try and change things from the inside.
Speaking of politics for a second, you all sang a song that I think is one of the most powerful political songs ever, Ohio After the Killings at Kent State. Were there debates amongst all of you about the potential impact? You actually called out Richard Nixon by name in the song, which was almost unheard of, at least in mainstream supergroups. Were there debates amongst all of you as to whether or not this was going to do damage to your career? Or
absolutely
to your
not.
Meaning just plowed right
let
into
me
it.
Tell you something. We had my song, Teach Your Children, going up into the top 20 when Kent State happened on May 4th, 1970. Mm-hmm. I was in Los Angeles with Stephen. I get a call from David. He says, you've got to book the studio. You've got to get Halverson there, and Bill Halverson, our engineer. You've got to get the, Fuzzy Samuels on bass and Johnny Barbado on drums, and you've got to book the studio. We're coming down. And I said, wow, you sound intense. Why? He goes, you wait until you hear this song that Neil wrote. And I said, what's it about? He goes, I can't tell you anything about it, but I'm telling you, it's about those four kids, and it's about the fact that America is finally destroying its own children. We have to come down and record it. They came down the next day. We recorded it. We recorded the B-side. We mixed both sides, gave it to Ahmet Erdogan, who was in the studio, and we put out that single 12 days later and killed our own single. They thought we were crazy. Record companies said, you don't do that. You don't have a single going up into the top 20 that may go into the top 10, may become number one. We did not care. America was killing its own children, and that was way more important.
We were speaking with Graham Nash about his musical career and his new book, Wild Tales. Up next, Emmett Price and Edgar B. Herbert III join us for their take on Michael Jackson's posthumous album, Xscape. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, today's show is all about music. Earlier this year, Emmett Price and Edgar B. Herrick III sat down with me and Emily Rooney to review Michael Jackson's posthumous album, Xscape. So, some people, I guess you could say in paranormal circles, say the dead can talk, but can they sing and release albums? It turns out the answer is yes. Michael Jackson's posthumous album, his second one actually, Xscape, was released this week. Here with us in Studio 3 for their reviews are Edgar B. Herrick III. We're going to play you a lot of music. Don't worry. The man behind GBH's Curiosity Desk and Emmett Price. Usually hear him on Mondays here. He's a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture, Towards Bridging the Generational Divide. Hello, gentlemen. And by the way, we are opening the lines.
Yes.
If you want to talk about the music, if you've heard it or hear it in a minute, if you're creeped out by the fact that it's yet another posthumous album from one of the greatest performers in the history of the world, you can tell us that too at 877-301-8970.
All right. So I don't even know. I haven't heard a word of this.
I've heard all of
Emmett,
it.
You haven't heard any of it?
Nope.
And you're somebody who likes Justin
person.
Timberlake, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the sort of lead single out of this, which was debuted at an event earlier this month, I guess May 1st was when it was first unveiled. There's a version that the lead single where it's one of those Justin Timberlake is singing with the dead Michael Jackson,
right,
and it's
really
all seamed together. Yes, Love Never Felt So Good. That's the name of the track.
I mean, kind of one of those Natalie Cole, you know, and her father, you know, Nat King Cole. Because, I mean, the track was actually recorded. The original was recorded in 1983. Justin Timberlake was 2 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, the spirit of, you know, someone singing with his mentor and really bringing this thing to life, I think it's a great track.
But yeah, we should be clear here. We're assuming people know more.
They don't know.
These are tracks that Michael Jackson actually did between, I think, 83 and 99 that have never been...
I think even later than that, 2000 something. I think the Xscape comes from the early 2000s.
Okay, the concept here is Antonio L.A. Reid, a phenomenal producer and part of the team of L.A. Reed and Babyface, who've written for everybody just about, comes up with this concept to it's about the 5-year anniversary of Michael's death. And he wants to go into the archives and find all of those tracks that were not released previously.
No.
And so he creates a filter, though. He says, you know, having worked with Michael before, he wants only songs that Michael recorded numerous times, you know, maybe, you know, 10 or 12 or 25 times, because he doesn't want to release things that Michael didn't really like. And Michael was a voracious, I mean, you know, he was in the studio and he worked. So he wanted these songs. So they came up with 8 tracks.
The other thing they did, which I think is important to say, is not only songs that Michael had recorded multiple times, but one of their other criteria is that they contain Jackson's vocals from top to bottom, which
exactly.
means they're full takes, right? So, you know, the things that Michael had recorded, it's worth saying, were still, even when recorded multiple times, were in demo form, ostensibly, right? They weren't finished and polished.
Yeah, that fact alone, isn't that a little bit disturbing, because he didn't get to finish the product.
I totally agree, and we should talk about that a little bit, because that's one of the pitfalls of any kind of reclamation project like this, right?
Yeah.
Where Michael Jackson isn't part of the process. And I think it's worth mentioning, and we'll listen to some music in a minute. I think it is really worth mentioning that, because in the case of Michael Jackson in particular, he was very active in the studio, in the production process. If you look at his greatest work, Off the Wall, Thriller, Bad, he's a co-producer with Quincy Jones on every one of those albums, which means that Michael had an active role in this. And, you know, you think about, I think about the song, the song Billie Jean, which is probably his most popular song ever, right? And the story behind that song is incredible. It's incredible. Michael's fighting for his vision of it. Him and Quincy Jones got into it over that song. First of all, Quincy Jones didn't want to put it on the album. Michael brought him a demo, and Quincy Jones was like, I don't really like the bass line. I don't really like this. Michael said, no, it works. Then they had this huge argument over the intro to that song.
Who was against that? Yeah. It's one of the greatest songs ever.
So Quincy Jones said, it's too long, Michael. It's got to go. It's like 40 seconds. We can't do it. Michael said, no. And this is the term he used. He said, but Quincy, that's where the jelly is.
And
Michael says the jelly is the thing that makes him want to dance.
Yeah.
And so when he sort of said it that way, Quincy said, well, who am I going to be to tell Michael Jackson to take the thing out that makes you want to dance?
Yeah,
he also made the bass guitarist, just by the way,
go ahead.
He made the bass guitarist bring every single one of his guitars into the studio and play them for him until Michael decided which bass guitar was going to be the right guitar.
Wow.
They also mixed the song 91 different times.
Now here's the hit. I mean, you have somebody who's very hands-on and heavy-handed on the whole recording process, let alone the mastering process and the release process. So the irony is that this song, Love Never Felt Like This, the song that we'll play shortly, would have been on that album. It would have been on that
album.
That's
true.
That's my concern. I listened to all 8 of these songs this morning. Not the on the deluxe version, you get the original demo, plus the contemporized, for lack of a better expression. I read that word 12 times this morning. And so I'm using it myself.
It's trending on
version,
Twitter.
But it seems to me, Em, at first, that if you really love the guy, like almost everybody did and does, is he wasn't happy enough, no matter how many times he did these tracks, to release them. So if he wasn't happy enough, why should we
be so okay with the notion that
an artist of this magnitude we get to hear when he didn't want us to hear it yet?
I can go with that, Jim, except for the fact, remember in 83, we were still doing concept albums. So it wasn't necessarily that he didn't like the track. The track didn't fit in the concept that he was putting together for the Thriller album. So, and here's the other catch. You have the producers who were working with Michael at the time, who were able to come back 15, 20 X amount of years later and actually, you know, try to finish the product in the spirit of Michael being there.
We're driving people crazy. They want to hear this.
Yeah, I was going to say, now that we've teased it out.
Let's listen to that
track that we've been talking about. This is, you know, in my estimation, the best, by far the best song on this album.
I agree.
Here's a little bit of that track. Dance. You hear Justin there. Let me see you move.
You know, in the words of Chris Matthews, I get a thrill up my leg. It is, as creepy as it is, and conflicted as I am about the issue we just discussed. That is one great song.
It's a great piece. I mean, it has the spirit of Michael. It has the energy of Michael. You want to just move to it. And then what perfect timing to release that for summer. I mean, this is going to be the hit that we're going to hear all summer long. And I guarantee you it'll be nominated for a Grammy.
So, but here's the interesting thing. And Jim, I'm like you. I'm very conflicted about this. And I think that this track works a lot better than many of the other tracks on this album. In part because
I think...
Are
they all mixed with other artists?
They're not all mixed with other artists.
This is the only one. Oh.
But this is the one for all of the contemporizing that I think
sounds
is the least
most like
contemporized.
Exactly.
Right?
I agree with that.
It happens to... And it's funny because I know that Timbaland and some of the people who were involved in this project talked about, you know, wanting to contemporize these because they're imagining, I want to hear this on the radio. How's it going to stand up against a Katy Perry song or whatever? And the truth of the matter is that this is one that, once again, something that Michael was good at throughout his career, which is capturing a moment in time or whatever. That idea of this disco-flavored sound just happens to be back in a little bit, right? Yeah. There's a little bit of an appetite for it. And because of that, you're able to take something and actually present it much like, this is the one that sounds most like what it would have sounded like, I think, in 82 or 83 if it was released then. And they're being more true to the spirit of the time of this track, and
in part, that's why
I think it
works. About this being the biggest hit.
Well, I mean, this track is timeless. It's going to be a hit, I guarantee you. But there are some sleepers on this album. There are some sleepers. There's a song called Slave to the Rhythm, which is classic Michael in this kind of danceable beat. And let's try this theory out. I think we have both versions. Let's play, you know, just a few seconds of the original.
Meaning the one that Jackson did
Michael
himself. Jackson's
which had been 1991. This was written by L.A. and Babyface in 1991. And it would have been on the Dangerous album. Mm. You know, the album that had Black or White or Remember the Time or Heal the World. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to the original clip just for a second.
So, Emmett, is that how it was ready to go? Had it gone on the album, would have gone like that?
They would have touched it up just a little bit. They would have polished it. They would have cleaned it up. But this was the raw kind of, you know, pre-mastered, you know, version of it. And, you know, Michael said no for whatever reason. Now let's juxtapose that to this newly finished, remastered, you know, version of the same song.
All right, I vote for the original.
So almost
kind of like the second one.
Do you? Yeah.
I mean, me too, Emily.
Me too. There you go.
You're a 21st century gal.
For me, almost invariably through this entire album, I've listened through it a couple times, the full deluxe version. I almost always like the original demos a little bit better. And I get why you can't release. Yeah. They sound like demos, right? They sound like demos.
The newly remastered piece brings in some new synth. You have some hip-hop stuff, some DJ, you know, kind of scratching in the back. And what it allows is to introduce this icon to a new generation who really wants to be a part of this whole appeal, but they were too young for it.
Yeah, but
so
does,
now they come in.
But does it need to be contemporized for them to like it?
Well, two things at play here. One, in the last probably 15 to 20 years, the role of the producer has risen.
That's true.
So you have the top producers in popular music now who have their hands in the cookie jar, you know, working on the magic sauce, you know. And the other piece is that now you have both versions released on this deluxe album. So you can, if you have this nostalgic piece, you can only listen to the old version.
Sure.
But if you like the new stuff with all the hip and the pop and the zip and the zoop and all that stuff on it, you can listen to the new version.
That's the voice of Emmett Price and Edgar B. Herwick III, and Emily Rooney is sitting in for Marjorie. And I'm sorry, Emily. Go ahead.
No, I was just... wondering how this happened, given the state of Michael Jackson's estate. I mean, did they all have to pass off on this? How did it get to this point? And who's going to make the money off of it?
Well, I mean, the estate is going to make the money, and there have been some issues with the family and whatnot, but the estate is in place, right? The question of terms of, you know, trusteeship and the ownership of the
estate.
Who
had to sign off on it?
Well, I mean, there's the co- trustees of the estate all signed. I mean, let's look at it this way. There has been, since 2011, the Michael Jackson Immortal World Tour, which has touched 3 million plus people, and it right now is the ninth top grossing tour of all time by Billboard magazine. And it's being traveled by the Cirque du Soleil, right, the kind of circus group and whatnot. So his music has been going around for years, and this is an opportunity to kind of build onto that. The estate is going to make buku moolah.
Okay, so let's step back for a minute, before we do the next song. And I love this album, by the way. After there were not every song was great, but I thought it was a thousand times better. I was ready for the worst case scenario. Yeah. Overall, Emmett Price, starting with you, and then Edgar, how would you rate this thing?
I think it's strong. I don't think it's top. I don't think it's the best, you know, album that will come out this summer. I don't think it's, you know, Michael's best material, but it certainly allows us to heal from that 2010 album Michael, which was absolutely horrific.
How about it, Edgar?
I'm going to make an analogy here, Jim, that will appeal to your Philadelphia roots.
Okay, go ahead.
I feel like this album is a lot like Rocky Balboa, the sixth Rocky movie.
Now, oh, that is horrible.
No, listen. No. And I'll tell you, no, it's not horrible, and I'll tell you why. Because the absolute, unequivocally worst Rocky movie that came out was Rocky V. It was so bad.
Agreed.
It was so egregious, right? And that's what that first posthumous release, Michael, was like.
Yeah. Agreed.
Then Rocky Balboa came out, which was not a great movie. It was arguably not even a good movie, but it was so much better than Rocky V.
It's a low threshold.
It sort of cleaned the bad taste out of your mouth. And I think that's what this is. I think this is a middle of the road record. I think this is one really strong track and a handful of other tracks that are okay. And I think that if you're a music lover and you're a real Michael lover, I think the real fun in this is the digging back into the versions that are more like just his demos. If you like him a lot, I think that you're going to get more satisfaction. I feel like you will get more satisfaction combing through them and hearing some of the process and hearing Michael more in his moments through time than in hearing the updated contemporized
versions.
Think
it's more like Star Trek 11 myself. Now,
is there another two?
Let me just mention one. I don't know if we have sound from this. The one that was most shocking to me is there was a song ages ago called A Horse With No Name.
Yes.
It was a song that was number one. Mm-hmm. It was done by Group America. When the song came out, and Michael Jackson was 14 at the time when it came out, everybody, because no one had ever heard of America, thought it was Neil Young. And Neil Young has many incarnations in many bands. Yep. The lead singer sounds a lot like one of the greatest writers and performers of all time, Neil Young. That's my little editorial comment. And so decades later, Michael Jackson redoes the song, calls it A Place With No Name, just with the same exact tune, and just changes the words.
Totally.
What did you think of that thing, Edgar?
There's two things. I think it's cool.
Go ahead.
No. I mean, as a song, I don't think the song is great by any stretch of the imagination. I think the updated version's neat because you don't quite hear it as clearly. When you hear the demo version, it's done with an acoustic guitar being strummed to that famous two-chord drone. Ding, ding, ding. But to me, the fascinating part of that is it also shines a window on Michael Jackson and what an omnivore as a musical lover he was.
Yeah,
because he's
a
person that I think people categorize in a certain way, like dance music or whatever. He had his disco era. He had his Motown era. He had his disco era. Then he had his kind of let's transform pop era. But I think Michael Jackson is a person, when you learn about him and read about him and understand what he thought about music, he listened to everything.
But he never did anything before where he took a song and not only did a cover of sorts, but a cover,
like a send-off,
rewriting the words. Yeah. I mean, no one's ever done. He hasn't done that. Did he ever do that?
No, he didn't do that.
Do we have a clip of that?
I don't know if we have that one.
Well, pick whatever you want, because we should hear more music. And by the way, if you want to participate in this discussion, 877-301-8970. If you've heard it and want to do a review, if you haven't heard it and want to talk to these guys or want to weigh in on the whole issue of the appropriateness of releasing such a thing with a guy without the guy signing off the artist himself, play something else for us, Emmett.
There's another sleeper on this album. It's called Escape. It's the title track. Now, this was, and Edgar mentioned it earlier, this was a song that he started with Rodney Jerkins, one of the phenomenal producers who's worked with just about everybody, Lady Gaga, Mariah Carey, J-Lo, Whitney Houston, Toni Braxton, Britney Spears. And they started this piece in 1999, and they didn't finish it until 2001. I mean, so it shows how of a perfectionist Michael was. And so let's listen to the original clip from, you know, circa 1999 to 2001 here of Escape.
No matter where I am, I see my face around. They've been lies on my name and put them down to town. Don't doubt
Jackson fan, you would have known that this was around the time that the album Invincible came out, which was his first full-length album in about 6 years. And on that album, you would have had songs like You Rock My World, Cry, Butterflies. So let's listen to the remastered, updated version with Rodney Jerkins going back and working on the tapes that he had worked with Michael Jackson.
Won't hide away.